So hopefully by just contemplating this shrine, even just for a few minutes, you're picking up something of Manjushri. So what we're going to do this evening, we're going to follow the similar format to when Tejaswini did an evening on Tara. I'm going to speak for a little bit, maybe 20 minutes or so. So do make yourself comfortable for a sit, a talk, short talk. And then we'll have a couple of minutes leg stretch so that if we need to use the bathrooms, they're called in America, loos in England. We'll have that. And then we'll go straight into a puja around focused on Manjushri. And then we'll have a tea break. So yes, today we're dropping into the amber or honey-coloured world of Manjushri or Manjushri. Now there are different colours for Manjushri. It was interesting coming in here to the shrine room and talking to Ratnagosha about the shrine, and I said, oh, those cornflowers are really beautiful. And he said, yes, and there is a form of Manjushri that's blue. And we both remembered having seen a painting of this particular Manjushri. I have to admit, I do not have a response to a blue Manjushri, but perhaps some of you might. You might think, oh, I'd love to have a blue Manjushri in my life. So the one that we're generally introduced to in Tri Ratna is orange, amber, ochre, tawny, brown, sort of in that orange, brown, honey-coloured range. But yes, there are these other colours, blue, red, white. That's the thing with these archetypes. They can shift around. And depending on which Buddha family they occupy, the colour of the archetypal bodhisattvas can change colour. But for me, coming along as I did to Tri Ratna many years ago and being introduced to this figure, it was the colour was part of what attracted me to the figure. So it's important that you kind of tune in to what you respond to in terms of colour in your life, because there can be resonances with what you're drawn to in your life and some of these figures. And it's worth it, you know, looking and spending time, seeing what you're actually drawn to in terms of colour, images, shapes, sounds, and seeing if they connect at all with some of these archetypal figures. Because usually you can find a connection. It might seem very tenuous, but there's a thread of connection there. And the sword, I mean, I was also intrigued by the sword. You know, I'd already learnt that these bodhisattvas were compassionate, loving figures, and yet there was this figure with a sword, which on the surface of it, one doesn't usually think of a sword as suggestive of compassionate activity. So I was kind of confronted with a figure that I found very beautiful, and there was a sort of koan in there. Well, what's this sword about? I don't know if that might apply for any of the rest of you. I mean, he hasn't always been a particularly popular archetype in Tri Ratna. And I've wondered sometimes whether that is because some people just don't read what the sword is about or get put off by the sword. So, of course, you, in a way, with all these images, I mean, I can kind of bring out some things, but to go deeper into them, one needs to kind of reflect oneself, well, what does a sword signify to you? What does it speak to you of? What are the connotations of a sword for you? Yes, it is a destructive implement. So then it's like, so what does this mean in an archetype of compassion? So where the clue is in the figure. You may not see it very clearly if you're sitting over this side of the room, but this figure is holding a book of perfect wisdom. Now, both these forms are called Manjushri because actually they've got a lotus. They're holding a lotus in the left hand, and on the lotus is a book, which is a text of perfect wisdom. Manjugosha is exactly the same archetype in terms of an expression of compassion and wisdom, but Manjugosha holds the perfection of wisdom to his heart. And that's the form of the meditation that we're introduced to in the order, if we choose to meditate on this figure. But you don't often see, you don't see so many depictions. You tend to see more depictions of Manjushri, as he's called, gentle glory, with the book on the lotus. Whereas Manjugosha, gentle voice, one has the book to his heart. But they're both basically concerned with the same thing, that the book is the perfection of wisdom. So this is the key to the sword, that the perfection of wisdom is held close to Manjugosha's heart. The truth is held close to his heart. The truth is what really matters to Manjugosha. And the perfection of wisdom, traditionally, is the profoundest form of an attempt to communicate the truth. Traditionally, the perfection of wisdom texts are brought up from the depths of the ocean. So that already there's a sense of they come from a deep place in the mind, in mind, in consciousness. And if you've read any of the perfection of wisdom texts, I mean, the Heart Sutra is one of the shortest and the one that we're introduced to very early on in our involvement in Sri Ratna. They challenge the rational mind, they challenge logic, because they usually, you know, they have contradictions within them. So on the one hand, one hears that there's form, and then you hear form is empty. Then you hear, well, emptiness is form, form is emptiness. There's this sort of play of logic, what seems to be logical impossibilities. How can you have one as well as the other? How can both be true? And it's perfection of wisdom texts are trying to kind of shock our minds into a different way of seeing the world that goes beyond this and that, either or, black, white, up, down, all the opposites that we live in all the time to different degrees. That's how our minds work. Everything's in relation to everything else, and so it's one thing or the other. How can it be both? How can that both be true at the same time? So Manjugosha has this truth that transcends the rational mind, that transcends logic, that transcends all dualism, close to his heart. And his sword is concerned with cutting through all the views and attitudes that we suffer from that aren't in accordance with that truth. So it's as if, you know, the sword is said to cut through our views like a knife, a sharp knife cutting through butter. So it's not a kind of sword that's going hack, 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 and it's all very bloody and gory and horrible. It's just really sort of that simple. When you really see through something, it's that simple. There's been all that effort in the run-up to seeing through. But when it happens, it's like, oh, okay. So sometimes, yes, these the confusions we labour under are described as veils. So again, you get a sense of this sword that cuts through these veils like silk, just slicing through. And yet, until that sword cuts through those veils, we live within those veils, a bit like a cocoon, the pupa of the butterfly living in the cocoon. We're cocooned from how things are because we have all these views and attitudes. And in a way, you could say, in our ignorance, we've all got swords anyway. We may not quite recognise it, but to the extent that we battle, as it were, we struggle with how things are, as in the events of life that present, that are presenting themselves to us every moment of the day, and we don't want something to be how it is. We want it to be a different way. That's not what we were expecting to happen, and this has just happened. And we can feel those resistances and struggles and tensions, and sometimes we fight that. Sometimes we try and, you know, destroy that reality. We want to make it into something else. We argue against what's happening. So in a sense, you could say that's us wielding swords out of ignorance, driven by ignorance, quite blindly, trying to cut away the obstacles to, well, a basic desire for pleasure and satisfaction. So in a way, there's a transmutation of that sword, that more ignorant use of a sword, into a skillful use of a sword through Manjugosha. One of the things about these figures, whether it's Manjugosha or any of these other archetypes, the same principle applies, is that if we meditate upon them on a regular basis, we enter into a relationship, as it were, with these figures, and we can begin to feel their presence in our lives, perhaps quite vividly, quite strongly. And at the same time, through the practices we do that connect with that that figure, there's also a sense that we know in our heart and hearts that these figures have no inherent existence, and yet we become deeply absorbed in them, deeply engaged in with them. Our emotional energy flows towards them, our mental energy, and yet at the same time, there's no substance to these figures. And this is part of the way of how these practices teach us the truth, because this is a kind of a sort of way in to pointing out the truth to us, that all the time this is actually what experience is, that it's vividly present, everything is vividly present and completely and entirely insubstantial. So it's possible through doing these practices that we open up to a deeper truth through the doorway of an archetype that really speaks to us and really grabs our attention, grabs our heart, if you like. So I was introduced to this practice 40 years ago now, and I was introduced to it very close to Cambridge, in a little cottage in Thetford Forest, where I had my private ordination ceremony, which was conducted by Sangharakshita. And Sangharakshita himself was introduced to this figure by one of his teachers, Jamyen Khyentse Rinpoche, in Darjeeling, that's in northern India, in 1957. And Jamyen Khyentse was regarded as a living embodiment of Manjugosha. Jamyang actually is another name for Manjugosha in Tibetan. So what that means is that Jamyen Khyentse was regarded as embodying the qualities of this archetype in how he lived his life. So it was very auspicious that Sangharakshita received the initiation into doing this practice from Jamyen Khyentse, and he was in fact strongly encouraged to do that from another of his teachers who had already introduced him to another meditation practice himself. So Manjugosha is one of the best known and important of the bodhisattvas in the Mahayana. And he kind of makes his appearance in sutras around the 1st or 2nd century AD. And he kind of appears fully formed, as it were, with no obvious precursors in earlier texts. And in the sutras, he's depicted as being both a bodhisattva, so as if he's a being on the path to awakening. And at the same time, he's described as being what's traditionally called a 10th stage bodhisattva, which basically means he's as good as a Buddha, really. He's fully enlightened. And as I indicated earlier, he's in a Buddha family, and in the sadhana, the visualization practice we do in Tri Ratna, he's in the Akshobhya family. So Akshobhya, the blue Buddha, sits on the crown of his head, and the other Buddhas are kind of also on the crown, but slightly to the back. But basically, in the practice, you imagine Manjugosha receiving all the blessings from all the Buddhas. So that represents that he's an embodiment of all the wisdom of the Buddhas. And this number five is symbolically important. And there are a couple of mountain ranges which are particularly associated with Manjugosha. And one of them is in northern India, a five-peaked range in the Himalayas called Perfumed Mountain. And the other one, which is much more famous, is Wu Tai Shan, which is a five-terraced mountain in China, where pilgrims still go to this mountain. There are many temples on the mountain, and there are many, many stories of people having visitations of Manjugosha on this mountain. And I was rereading a description the other day about one, and they often seem to manifest as these kind of coloured balls of light moving through the sky. And the person who was describing this vision said, well, okay, it might be some sort of strange atmospheric phenomena, but actually it was amazing. You know, in a way, it's like, it's what you make of something, isn't it? If you've kind of built up this whole feeling for something, an association, then you see these orange balls of light floating through space, well, you know, why not let it be Manjugosha? Why not? If it speaks to you. Yes, and there are other legends. There's quite a lot of different legends associated with him. And one actually, it goes so far as to have him in a human form coming from China. And he's actually credited with having created Nepal, the actual country of Nepal, through... Well, apparently there was a vast lake that completely covered the Kathmandu Valley. And the legend is that Manjugosha, who was probably a great hulking guy, and certainly with a great big sword, turned up and basically slashed these five river valleys to the south of the lake and drained all the water out and magically transported all the dragons that lived in the lake to a new lake. And then he kind of went back to China and disappeared completely and back into his archetypal form. So it's quite interesting, I think, some of these stories that have grown up. And actually in the texts where you sort of read stories about Manjugosha, there are quite a number where he's involved in teaching Nagas, these serpent dragons. And again, I sort of think, well, that probably is linked to his association with the perfection of wisdom texts, which come from the depths of the ocean. This is where these Nagas live. But there's one story in the Gandavyur Sutra where Manjugosha, this is quite near the beginning of the sutra, he basically turns up at a shrine outside this beautiful city. And it's a shrine where Buddhas have taught before. And thousands and thousands and thousands of these Nagas basically turn up from the depths of the ocean. They've all come to learn the Dharma. And they know that apparently, traditionally, Nagas can't gain full enlightenment in a Naga form, sadly. But they do so well under Manjugosha's guidance that they can't help but get reborn as humans or gods. And then basically, they all end up being high-level bodhisattvas. One can think, oh, that's an interesting story, but it's like, it's worth contemplating, what might this mean, what might this suggest about the forces and energies of mind, of psyche, that kind of are drawn to the Dharma, but maybe, you know, they're going to have to change quite radically to really, really get on board, and how does that happen, and those processes are quite mysterious, and yet, in a way, the story says, well, okay, it can happen. It can happen. The wildest energies, the deepest energies, can get involved in this project of enlightenment. And I think it's, you know, these things are important, because sometimes I think these figures can seem so beautiful and refined and maybe a bit remote. And meanwhile, here are we, you know, feet of clay. But sometimes the clues, you know, are in these more mythical stories of the kind of wilder energies, and how there is a way, there can be ways to engage these energies. There are ways, there has to be ways, because we're so many things. We experience such a range in our life. There's also humour in some of the stories about Manjigosha's compassionate activity, and there's one where the story begins where Purna has been trying to convert a whole community of Jains, to the Dharma, and he hasn't really made any progress. He hasn't managed to convince them that they need to kind of alter their viewpoint and embrace the Dharma. So in the story, Manjigosha basically conjures up 500 make-believe disciples, and he disguises himself, and then he and his apparent followers all turn up at Satchakar's camp. Satchakar's the leader of this community, and they prostrate to Satchakar, and Manjigosha, as the spokesman, just says, well, we've heard so much of you and you're a great teacher. Basically, he really praises him. And of course, Satchakar is completely won over and is more than happy to have all these new followers join his company. But then, of course, once they're in part of that community, basically, they start to make friendships, make connections with all these other followers. So they befriend the other Jains, and once they've won their trust, basically Manjigosha then starts to teach them the Dharma. And basically, at a certain point, a whole lot of them just get it. It's said that 500 of them experience the opening of the Dharma eye, and 8,000 others generate the bodhicitta. And at that point, all the kind of make-believe followers, the 500 that had come with Manjigosha, suddenly just throw themselves on the ground and prostrate and say, salutation to the Buddha, salutation to the Buddha. And as soon as they say that, all the rest of the Jains just like get swept up in this sense of, oh, yes, and they all prostrate and say, salutation to the Buddha. And at that point, Satchakar just says, okay, you win. I convert. So again, it's a sort of amusing story, and it's got, skillful means. It's got all sorts of things in it you could think about. Where at what point you sort of maybe don't say the full truth. You just kind of make a connection, and then you start saying the truth. Something else I just want to bring in about Manjigosha is that, and this is something that Sangharakshita has drawn out, you'll find it in his lecture on Buddhism and culture, which is in the Sutra of Golden Light lecture series. And he mentions the fact that Manjushri, over time, he became regarded as a patron of the arts and sciences and an inspirer of literature and supreme eloquence. So what Sangharakshita indicates is that he says he thinks this indicates that Manjigosha symbolises the profoundest wisdom expressed in terms of the most highly developed culture. And he makes the connection between Manjigosha's ornaments, the jewels, the necklaces, etc., and culture. To quote, in the person of Manjigosha, culture has been fully assimilated, fully absorbed. Culture is, if you like, represented by the ornaments that sparkle on the golden body of Manjigosha. He then goes on to say something which I find quite interesting, which I would have come across this many years ago, but I recently came across it again and thought, oh, that is interesting. It merits further reflection, and it does very much connect with an aspect of how we teach in Tri Ratna, or an aspect of the Tri Ratna tradition. Anyway, I'll read out the quote from the lecture, and there isn't time to go into it, but as a signing, it does merit contemplating. So Sangharakshita suggests, and this is quoting him, it's possible for the Dharma to be taught without the medium of culture, but only in the context of a close and intense spiritual relationship between teacher and disciple. This whole question of Buddhism and culture is therefore a very important one. Culture occupies a very important place in our lives, even a very important place in our spiritual development. Yes, I think that is interesting. That if one's not in a position to have that close and intense spiritual relationship between a teacher and the disciple, then culture is very important as part of the medium through which the Dharma is taught. So yeah, I think we need to think about that and really see what we make of that. Because we do emphasise the arts and culture in Tri Ratna, and we do encourage that as an aspect of what is developed at the centre. But perhaps we could make more of what that is meant to be supporting if we kind of bore in mind this quote a bit more. But also the converse, I think, to think, well, okay, maybe sometimes in some context one can have that more intense connection, and then maybe yes, the culture isn't so important at that time. So again, it's to do with conditions. What are the conditions we need to really hear the Dharma and for the Dharma to really penetrate and for us to make the connections that make it alive for us? But in terms of culture, I just want to flag up, he's not here this evening. Ratnagarbha has been plugging away, creating this beautiful magazine, Earthona, for a long time now. And there was a new edition out recently, and that's very much about this whole area, exploring the place of the arts and culture in spiritual life. And I do, if you've never looked at an Earthona, I do recommend you either dipping into back copies, I'm sure there are some in the library, or just having a look in the ones in the bookshop. I've been very struck by Ratnagarbha's passion, as it were. And it's a very beautifully produced magazine, and it's got a very wide readership, I believe. And it's not a Tri Ratna, you know, platform. It's very broad, and he has, you know, articles and pieces by all sorts of people in the arts world. So yeah, I did just want to bring in that dimension of Manjigosha. And I think one can sort of perhaps, yeah, make those connections through the beauty, the association of beauty with him. Yes, I haven't said much about his speech in terms of we'll have a reading tonight which Guhya Prabha will be giving, which communicates the 64-fold voice. Traditionally, this is the voice, the communication that can speak to anyone. So it's a sort of quality where simultaneously everybody can find something that is meaningful for them in just one voice. So a voice with these 64 qualities. And it's considered like one of the skills that Manjugosha bestows if you're truly devoted to him, that he will help you become a better and better Dharma teacher. Yes, and traditionally some teachers have put a great emphasis on that, and you find that in the Buddhist tradition. People like Tsongkhapa, who's from the 16th century Tibet, and Shantideva, and they attribute their, not only their Dharma knowledge, but their eloquence entirely to Manjugosha. And if you come across readings and stories, you'll always see them dedicating, either invoking Manjugosha before they give a teaching, or dedicating the teaching to Manjugosha at the end. So it's interesting, this sense of the archetype carrying qualities that one's not necessarily that conscious of on a certain level, but you can sort of tune in and open up to and receive, as it were, and they come through and other people pick up on them. So I think I've said enough for now. I've sort of jumped around all over the place, but I hope I've given you a bit of a flavour of Manjugosha, Manjushri.